Dr. Alex Malpass, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good too.
Okay.
First of all, can you introduce yourself?
So I'm Alex Malpass. I'm, I guess, known on the internet, YouTube stuff for doing philosophy of religion. I'm an atheist. I have a background in academic philosophy. I have a PhD, and I used to teach many years ago. And these days, I write philosophy for a kind of hobby, but I'm still publishing papers in good journals. So I'm still got my foot in the game, kind of thing, even though I'm not doing it for a job anymore.
Okay, so before we start the discussion, you're from England, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm sorry first if I sound stereotypical, but do you watch football? The international football, not the American one.
Yeah, sure.
So, do you have any favorite club at the moment?
No, not really. I don't support a team as such. I'm not like a massive football fan. I've been following England in the Euros, and they are quite disappointing at the moment, which is just standard for being an England fan, I think. They always build you up to so you expect them to do well, and then they're rubbish, frankly. So that's quite annoying.
Yeah, so in Indonesia, football is a very big thing, and currently there are so many event held being held for watching the game together in Indonesia. And I myself is an England fan since World Cup 2018. And yeah, you can already imagine the disappointment that both of us had about for that country. Okay, so I think this will be a lot better. So I'm going to challenge you to explain the questions that I'm going to have in the next next session with football terms. So yeah, so maybe it will be a lot easier for us all lay people to understand such complex philosophical terms. So
I'll do my best.
let's okay. What is Grim Reaper paradox?
I might bear with me if I'm not getting a football analogy for this one right off the top of my head, but
Okay.
the Grim Reaper paradox is a paradox in general in philosophy is something basically it's like an inference that looks correct, but where the conclusion is impossible. And so that's what a paradox means. Something has gone wrong somewhere with some reasoning. And in this case, there's different ways of putting it, but generally there's a kind of contradiction that you can derive from a setup that when you first think about it seems like it should be possible. But if it leads to something that's impossible, then it seems like something's gone wrong in the setup. So there's a kind of family of paradoxes. The Grim Reaper is one version of that. But the so I guess I'll explain that one in particular. So even with this version, there are many different subversions of it. But let's think about an hour between 12 midday and 1 o'clock, and at 12:30 there is a Grim Reaper, and so it's the guy with the scythe who's the kind of harbinger of death or whatever, and he's waiting to see if Fred is still alive at 12:30. And if Fred is still alive, then the Grim Reaper is determined to kill him, basically. But also, it turns out there's another Grim Reaper. So the first one was like halfway between 12 and 1. The next one is halfway between 12 and that Grim Reaper, so he's at 12:15. And he also has the same plan. He's going to kill Fred if Fred is still alive at 12:15. And then there's another one who's halfway between 12 o'clock and that Reaper, so he's at like 7.5 minutes past 12. And he's determined to kill Fred if Fred's still alive at 7.5 minutes past. And we just keep going, adding Reapers in ever smaller and smaller increments, a bit like Zeno's paradox, if you're familiar with the tortoise and the hare. So we fit that never-ending sequence of Grim Reapers ever closer to 12 o'clock, right? So the last one is at 12:30, and it's just a beginningless sequence, if you like, going back ever closer towards 12 o'clock. Now, I mean, you might think there's something already a bit dubious about being able to fit that many Reapers into a small space. But basically, that's what this version of the paradox is going to try and say is impossible. But the thought is just, well, could Fred survive till 1 o'clock? And the answer to that is clearly no, because if he'd got as far as 12:30, then that Reaper would kill him if he was still alive. But then again, so he's not going to make it all the way. But for any Reaper, if you think about that Reaper, like the 12:30 Reaper, it's also true that that Reaper isn't going to kill Fred, because for that, Fred will not have made it that far. For him to have made it to 29 minutes past 12, he'd have had to have made his way through an infinite number of Reapers, each of which was determined to kill him if he'd made it that far. So definitely he won't be killed by the 12:30 one. But that's true for every Reaper. Pick any Reaper. There's already an infinite sequence of Reapers between that one and 12 o'clock for any Reaper that you pick. So there's no way for each one that that one can kill him. But also, there's no way for Fred to get to the end without being killed. So it seems like he's going to get killed, but none of them are going to kill him. And that's one way to see how this is contradictory. So in this case, you might think that the what it's showing you is that you can't have infinitely divisible sequence like that, because on its own, a Reaper that's determined to kill someone if he's alive at that point, that seems possible. So it doesn't seem like you could just deny that. So the weakest link in the premises seems to be the one that assumed that you can fit Reapers into ever smaller and smaller intervals. So maybe there's some minimum unit of time that you can't divide any further or something. That's how some people use this argument. But we can also sort of modify the setup a little bit, and instead of cramming them into ever smaller and smaller time intervals, we can just suppose that they're equally spread out. So there's one Reaper every year, let's say, and suppose that there's no beginning to time. So there's still an infinite number of Reapers, but they're just spaced out evenly. One every, say, New Year's Eve or something wakes up and sees if Fred is still alive and kills him if he is. And we get the same paradox going on there. So if the original one shows us that you can't divide time ever further, then this one also seems to show us that time must have a beginning, because if it was endless, you could just fill up time, or beginningless, I suppose. You could just fill up that range with Reapers if you wanted to, and if you did, that would lead to this contradiction. So it seems like the weakest link is the assumption that time could have no beginning. So there's two ways that argument. So what's the relevance for that in the philosophy of religion is that there's sort of Kalam-style cosmological arguments, which have, they say like anything that begins to exist has a cause. That's premise one, and then premise two will be the universe began to exist. And now that second version of the Grim Reaper argument I just showed seems to show us that time must have a beginning, in which case it's a support for that second premise in the Kalam cosmological argument. And that's how it's used by contemporary people. I mean, William Lane Craig, who's the big Kalam defender, has these days points to the Grim Reaper as one of the ways that he endorses of defending that second premise. And it's been put forward by Alexander Proust and Robert Coons recently in the philosophy literature. So it's kind of a hot topic at the moment. Fair amount of papers being published on that topic. So yeah, it's quite interesting. Hopefully that was, did that make sense as an explanation?
It makes sense. So far, it makes
Good.
sense.
Good.
What I'm trying to ask you is, how does this paradox affect the Kalam cosmological argument?
Well, as I said, it's used as a support for the second premise in the Kalam these days. So instead of the Hilbert's Hotel argument or the successive addition argument, those are the other two philosophical arguments that William Lane Craig usually trots out to defend that second premise. These days, this is a sort of third philosophical argument that's used to defend it.
Okay. When you're explaining about the paradox, I was thinking about a Fred, the footballer, the footballer from Brazil. He was a Manchester United
Yes,
player.
that's right.
I'm a fan of Manchester United, by the way. So yeah.
Actually, cool. My
So I was
sympathies for
thinking,
you.
hey, at least they won the FA Cup. That's pretty much something.
Yeah,
Man,
okay.
Joe said about that about Manchester United also. So yeah, okay, that's the fate to become a Manchester United fans. Okay, by the way, so I was thinking about he was destined to score a goal in minute one, but if he don't score the goal at the first minute, then he will be scoring in the second minute. If he's not, and then he scored at the third, and then so on and so on, at an infinitum. So yeah, if I try to think it that way, it's impossible, because first of all, the football matches is limited to 90 minutes. That's the first thing, and then yeah, I kind of got lost in my own thought now. Okay, can you help me with using football term in this one?
Sure. Okay. So here's one way you could think about it, that that Fred is making a run from the halfway line towards the goal, and there's a defender that's on the edge of the penalty box, which is basically halfway between the halfway line and the goal line, and that defender's going to tackle Fred if Fred makes it that far, right? But there's also another defender who's halfway between the halfway line and the edge of a penalty area, and he'll tackle Fred if he gets that far too. And there's another one, halfway between that distance again. And so we can cram an ever like denser arrangement of defenders, each of which will tackle Fred if he was to make it that far. And that way, is Fred going to make it to the goal line? No, because there's going to be infinitely many defenders, each of which will tackle him if he was to get that far. But pick a defender. Is that defender going to tackle Fred? No, because Fred would have had to have made it past infinitely many defenders already by the time he gets there. So that one definitely won't tackle
Okay, that makes sense to me now,
him. Okay, good.
100%. So the solution about that, you have to use footballing terms. Okay. Okay,
Yes.
so next time, if I have more questions about this kind of paradoxes, I will ask you about to explain in footballing terms. But I believe my next question won't require such terms. You said that this paradox wasn't being the solution of this paradox is not causal finitism. Why is that, and what is causal finitism?
Okay, so causal finitism is the view that there's for any effect, like any event really that's caused, it'll have a causal history. That is all of the things that happened in the chain of cause and effect that led up to that thing happening. Like Fred scoring a goal, there's got to be all the passes that happened in the history of that and all the training that he did or something, right? But causal finitism says that causal story, the history of that event, say this goal, that can only be finite. There can't be infinitely many previous causes in the history of that effect. So there might be a chain, but if it's a chain, it terminates at some point in the past. It doesn't keep going forever. So this kind of story about the world resting on a turtle, and that turtle resting on another turtle, and then the thought would be it's turtles all the way down. Causal finitism is saying it can't be turtles all the way down when it comes to causes. They can only be finitely far into the past. So that view is offered as a kind of the idea is that the lesson we should learn from the Grim Reaper paradox is that causal finitism is true, right? So if cause, and the reason is that if causal finitism is true, then you can't really have infinitely many reapers or defenders, as we were talking about earlier, because what that would be, whether it's them crammed into a finite space or if it's them extended over an infinite interval, either way, what you would have is an event which has infinitely many things happening before it, right? Like this reaper who's going to kill Fred if and only if none of the previous ones have, or this defender who will tackle Fred if and only if none of the previous ones have. And the fact that his action depends on the previous ones for what he should do means it's causally related to those. So there's a kind of causal chain that stretches backwards, and it doesn't have a first member. It just keeps going forever. And that's crucial to all of these versions of the Grim Reaper paradox. So if causal finitism is true, it just gives you kind of a principled reason for thinking that you can deny the relevant premise, the one that says there is infinitely many of these reapers lined up with, you know, no beginning to them. That's a reason to, like, if you already embrace causal finitism, then you've got a principled reason to reject that part of the argument, and thereby avoid the kind of strangeness of the paradox. So one way of thinking about it is that, you know, you can study a paradox like this and learn something about the nature of the world. That's what these philosophers think, that you can kind of figure out that, say, time must have a smallest interval, which seems like the sort of thing you can't figure out just from the armchair. You expect to have to do experiments or something and get some particle accelerators or whatever. But the philosophers in this sort of tradition think that you can deduce things about the way that the world is, or at least have good reasons to come to believe something about the way the world is, purely on the basis of these abstract speculations. So it's a priori metaphysics is kind of technical term for that. And as you said, I'm not of the view that this paradox has those types of implications. So I think there are other things you can say instead of having to conclude that the world has a particular, that is, that the world is like anything, right? I think that, so these paradoxes go back to this philosopher who's called Jose Bernadetti, who wrote a book in the 60s in which he explained all of this. Of this paradox and a bunch of other stuff. It's a really, really fun book. It's called Metaphysics Infinity, an Essay in Metaphysics, I think it's called. But in there, there's a really, because often it's he's wheeled out as if he is a supporter of causal finitism. And William Lane Craig says, you know, often says, quotes from Bernadetti as if Bernadetti's making the same point that Craig is endorsing this kind of finitist view. In actual fact, Bernadetti is very critical of that type of idea. He's very scathing of the thought that you could, from the armchair, make deductions about the nature of what the world is like. I think he says something like, it's preposterous that you could deduce something about, like, whether the number of stars in the heavens is even or odd, without having to go out there and look at them all and, like, count them. If you could just sort of figure out some argument that proved it had to be even or something, he just thinks that sort of thing is preposterous. But that's precisely what these causal finitists use his argument to do. So it's exactly the sort of thing he wouldn't want to do. And it seems to me that I'm representing more the kind of train of thought that the original person who put this argument forwards had, where he didn't think it told you that the universe must be finite in some respect. He just thought that you have to be more creative and come up with different approaches to stuff. So that's very general and vague, but since in the last few years, me and a couple of other people have been working on a range of different responses to this. Joe Schmid and myself have published a couple of papers. Joe's a complete machine for publishing stuff all the time, so I can't keep up with him. He's published a bunch of other stuff as well. But we have a paper forthcoming, which is on something that's called the unsatisfiable pair diagnosis, which is a term that we get from another philosopher, Nicholas Shackle, published a paper in 2005 about the Bernadetti paradox. So that's before this wave of philosophy of religion started thinking about this Grim Reaper stuff. Shackle, who's not in philosophy of religion, he's a sort of logician or philosophical logician, was studying this for different reasons. But he came up with this analysis of the paradox, which basically says, the sort of simplest way to put it is just that the paradoxical setup, the story that we tell about the Grim Reapers, you know, lying in wait to tackle Fred, sounds like a story that you could just tell, but hidden inside the story is a contradiction, and it just means that you're expressing a set of propositions that are mutually inconsistent. And It's obviously the case that if you do that, what at least one of them must be false, right? They can't all be true because they contradict one another. And setting aside this question of like, presumably there can't be contradictions, right? So if that's right, then something's gone wrong with this. But it's nothing needs to be said about the nature of the world or something. It's just logical contradictions obviously can't obtain. This is a logical contradiction. So that's all you have to say about it. Now, it seems to me that like one way to understand this idea, and I think it's quite subtle and often misunderstood by people, but one way to think about it, which goes back to this paper by a philosopher called Arthur Pryor, who was a guy who invented the A theory of time and a lot of cool stuff in the 60s and in logic. But he has this paper which is about paradoxes that are kind of similar to this, but also completely unrelated. But he draws a lesson from studying those paradoxes that seems to me is a basically the spirit of the unsatisfiable pair diagnosis. So his paradox was something like that you're sitting in a room in a university and it's your office, and down the hall from your office is a different professor, and you think he's a complete idiot, right? And everything he says is false. But, and you say to yourself, you're in room 15 and he's two doors down in room 13. And you think to yourself, everything the professor in room 13 thinks is false, right? As a way of expressing that you think he's always wrong whenever he says anything. But you don't realize that overnight the cleaners changed the numbers of the room. So actually, he's in room 15 and you're in room 13. So what you did is accidentally refer to yourself when you said that the professor in room 13 always says some false things, never says any true things. But then it's paradoxical because, I mean, if that's true, then it's talking about yourself, saying that you never say anything true, but you just said something true about yourself. And so there's a contradiction there, right? It can't be that you never say anything true, and also that you truly say that you never say anything true. So there's a kind of like circularity failure or something that's going on there. But when thinking about that, Pryor says, it kind of seems like it should be possible, right, to say that sentence, the proposition, the person in room 13 always says false things. That seems like the sort of thing that you are able to think. But actually, when you try and think it in cases like this, the thought kind of crumbles, and its circularity means it's not really expressing anything at all. So it's surprising because you think you would imagine you could form that thought, but when you try and do it, it turns out you can't. And there's a surprising kind of block there. And what explains your inability to form that thought? Well, logic is the reason why you can't, right? Logic sort of explains why that thought never actually expresses anything. It's not metaphysics. There's no physical impediment to you doing it. You can try and do it, but you're definitely going to fail. And the reason for that failure is because there's a kind of blockage that you didn't realize was there. And you find out that that's there by doing this type of analysis, right? And then, so the lesson is that there's some, you can discover a kind of like a topology or something, like a kind of landscape that you weren't previously aware of. You're kind of like finding your way around it using the light of your own reason to illuminate this landscape. And it's different to what you thought it was going to be like. When you do think about it, you go, oh, this is unusual. There's a kind of block here, and I can't go that way like I thought I could. So it's something like finding a blockage that stops you moving around this landscape of reason. Sorry, it's quite an abstract way of putting it, but seems to me that's what's going on with this Benedetti paradox as well, the Grim Reaper paradox, because it seems like you should be able to, for instance, if we've got a beginningless past, it feels like, well, an individual Grim Reaper is possible, and my mind expects to be able to copy and paste that Grim Reaper throughout, like wherever there's room for him, I can put a new copy of him if I want to. And that means if the past is infinite, I should be able to put infinite copies of that Grim Reaper there. That's what my rational expectation is. But it turns out when I analyze the consequences of that, that doing so leads to a contradiction. And so, just like prior realizing I can't really form the thought that I expected to be able to because it's incoherent, it turns out that I can't really tell the story about Grim Reapers that I thought I was going to be able to, because to do so is to just contradict myself. And that's what's going on. It's a kind of unexpected limitation to constructing hypothetical thought experiments. It turns out that we have to let logic teach us what the boundaries are around these types of mental kind of thought experiments. I don't know if
In
that's a
your
helpful way of putting it or not.
in your podcast, and if I'm not mistaken, in the paper as well, you said that this paradox is more logical than it is metaphysical. What do you mean by that?
So what I mean is that instead of drawing conclusions about the way that the world is, like for instance, that the world has to have a beginning or something, we're just simply saying that like I was just trying to explain then, we're just finding out that logic is teaching us that our thoughts kind of can't go to this location, actually. It's like not a real thing. So there is nothing to solve. It's just So here's another way of thinking about it that's more familiar, perhaps. In standard time travel movies, like say, take Terminator 2, right? And the Terminator comes back and he's trying to kill John Connor. And John Connor goes on to be the leader of the resistance or whatever. Now, there's something kind of immediately paradoxical because you think if the Terminator succeeds in killing John Connor, then John Connor doesn't grow up to be the leader of the resistance, in which case they wouldn't have sent the Terminator back to kill him. Because there's nobody to kill, in which case he wouldn't have come back. So he wouldn't. And so you're in this kind of loop where it never really makes sense if he kills John Connor. But on the other hand, it makes perfect sense if he doesn't kill John Connor, because that's the Terminator. John Connor does grow up to be the leader of the resistance, and the Terminator kind of doesn't kill him. And then you have a consistent storyline that just is, logically coherent from start to finish. So what that seems to show is that the Terminator, kind of logically speaking, can't kill John Connor, right? No matter what he tries to do, he's not going to be able to do that. And some people think that that is implausible and requires a metaphysical explanation, like that there's some Time Lord or something, like from Doctor Who like intervenes and sort of nudges the Terminator's gun at the last minute to prevent him from killing John Connor, and that without some kind of something about the world physically preventing him from completing his task, he would be able to, right? But the line that I'm taking is just simply the other main philosophical thing to say about the time travel cases is simply that nothing need get in his way. It's simply that the fact that it would be logically contradictory were he to succeed is itself enough of a barrier, right? Just simply the fact that that can't happen. I mean, here's another example. So there's this town in, I guess, Germany, it used to be Prussia, called Königsberg, which is where Kant lived. Anyway, it's also where this mathematician Euler came up with the beginnings of graph theory. And it's got the thing about it is it's got seven bridges crossing over a river, which I think forks halfway through the town. So it's kind of an unusual river thing. But the idea, you'd think to yourself, I'm going to set myself a job of walking across each bridge once each, and I won't double back on myself. And you think it should be possible to do that. It just turns out that it's not possible. Now, people used to actually try and do it to see, and everybody who tried would fail. And Euler came up with a sort of mathematical analysis of why it wasn't possible to do it. So now we know that given graph theory, it's like basically mathematically impossible, geometrically impossible to do the thing that people thought they would be able to do. Just like it's sort of logically impossible for the Terminator to kill John Connor. And that's the same thing here. It's just actually not logically possible to have all of the Grim Reapers in that arrangement. But and following the rule, which is that they kill Fred if and only if Fred's still alive. It's just a logical impossibility. So you don't need to say anything like, oh, there's some invisible time lord that, prevents the Reapers from doing something. Just like you don't have to say an invisible time lord stops you from crossing the bridges, right? You just can't do it. And once you understand the logic, there's nothing else to be said about why you can't do it. That's the thought.
Okay, I'm trying
Sorry, none of
to
those analogies were footballing analogies. I should have tried to come up with a footballing analogy.
I try to get it back into football, but then when you talk about the Terminator story, it start to make sense to me. But at least this is how I conclude about this old story about this logical problem and metaphysical thingy is that it's not satisfiable in terms of it's not even logically. It's a paradox. Okay, it's a paradox in logic. So there's no need, or maybe there's no way for it to be solved in a metaphysical term, because it's not even possible in a logic sense. So what I'm trying to at least to make a conclusion for myself is this is a logical problem. It's a full stop. You cannot postulate something about the metaphysics or how God somehow make the paradox even possible and things like that, because it won't solve anything. Yeah, it will be a lot. I will be. I will perhaps can explain it more clearly when I type it, because English not my first language. But do you get a sense of what I'm saying about
Yes,
this?
definitely. And I think there's this worry, which is that, like sometimes if you have a piece of clothing and there's like a loose thread and you pull at the thread and then it just keeps coming and then everything's unraveling or whatever. There's something like that here as well, because if you think to yourself, well, the paradox, the original version of the paradox where we have the defenders closer and closer to each other towards the halfway line. Well, does that tell us, like, what's the lesson we should draw from that? Is it that you can't divide a football pitch infinitely many times? That because if so, that means that space has to have a smallest unit to it. But also, Grim Reapers spread out over time. If you can't have that, then does that mean there has to be a smallest unit of time as well as the smallest unit of space? And if we have them evenly spread out across time, that seems to show us that time has to have a beginning. But also, you can arrange a future version of it where each Reaper will kill Fred if and only if none of the future ones will. And then what does that show us? That time must have an end as well. And we could line up the Reapers, on a just one every mile throughout an infinite space where, each Reaper kills Fred if and only if none of the ones to his left kill Fred. In which case, that shows us that space must have an edge as well. I mean, so now we've seemed to have deduced that both space and time have a smallest unit that's in undivisible, a kind of quanta or atom, but also that they have an edge. The left over there, the space comes to an end. Over there, space comes to an end. And in front of us in time comes to an end. And behind us in time has a beginning. And all of this just, it just feels like I can just make a new version of the paradox, just cash it out in a new thought experiment. And then you have to concede another metaphysical point in order to block up the problem, right? So maybe it's like a dam that's bursting and you're trying to put your finger in the holes to stop the water coming out, but there's just too many holes because I can keep making new ones. Or we can have ones that have nothing to do with space and time whatsoever. I mean, let's just suppose there's a set of sentences, right? Like T1, T2, T3, T4, etc. And we just say for each one of them, Tn is true if and only if none of the Tn plus m is true, like none of the greater ones are true. So then it's just the same paradox, but it's nothing to do with causation. It's a kind of completely semantic paradox. And are we supposed to say, okay, also even abstract semantic paradoxes, then there must be some kind of constraint, which means that chains have an end to them in that context too, kind of dependency finitism as well or something. It just feels like a never-ending series of concessions that the person who wants to take a metaphysical approach to it has to give, whereas the The alternative, this unsatisfiable pair diagnosis, basically says nothing needs to be given, no ground needs to be given metaphysically, and therefore it's a lot cleaner as a as an approach, right? It's, if we think about like theoretical virtues, it doesn't ask as much. It's a kind of cheaper theory, and that means it's more of a bargain. If the theory is cheaper, but it does the same work as another theory, which is kind of more costly in terms of its commitments, you want the cheaper one. That's it's more of a bargain. The other one seems like a bit of a ripoff. So that's one way to think about it. And I guess it's important to say, like, that I think some people misunderstand what's going on, because they'll want to know, like, which premise in the argument is being denied by this analysis. And everything I've said so far just makes it seem like all I need to say is, well, there's a contradiction, so it doesn't matter, we don't need to say anything. But of course, if you've got a set of premises which lead to a contradiction, then at least one, possibly many, of those premises are false. But it's and the causal finitists are going to say, you know, the dodgy premise is the one which says that there's an infinite sequence of whatever it is, reapers across time or space or whatever. They're going to reject that premise. And if the unsatisfiable pair, if it's an alternative, like, it should be saying which premise it denies, right? And it seems to me that the right thing to say is that it's the premise which is sometimes referred to as a kind of patchwork principle or recombination principle. So it's, the thought was, you know, if we've got enough room, then I can copy and paste the reaper so that it fills up that space. Right? So if we've got an infinite number of years, I can copy and paste one reaper an infinitely many times so that they're all lined up in the right way to get the paradox going. So instead of denying the premise which says that there can be an infinite past, I'm going to deny the premise which says that you can fill it with infinitely many reapers. So it's the recombination principle. So the thought is that if there are two things that are spatio-temporally distinct, right, two just objects like a cup and a bowl or whatever, then if one of them is possible on its own and the other one's possible on its own, then there should be a third state of affairs, which is both of them next to each other, right? So you should be able to rearrange things, and any combination of those things is itself a distinct possibility. That's the kind of basic patchwork principle. Simple, and it's plausible when you first think about it, that patchwork principle, because you do think, well, I can imagine a dragon and I can imagine a unicorn and I can imagine them both standing next to each other, and there doesn't seem to be any problem with that. And so you might think it's a kind of guide that shows you around the landscape of possibilities, and it's showing you what's possible. But the very simple version of that theory of the patchwork principle is rejected by basically everybody, because you have to say more than that. It can't just be anything that doesn't overlap. I mean, the very minimum, you're going to have to say something like, you know, that there are space-time kind of constraints. I mean, I can take a region of like 11-dimensional string theoretic whatever space-time. I can't just copy and paste that on to just like this bit of four-dimensional space-time that we're sat in right now, because the two things are completely like, they don't like fit together naturally. So there's obviously, there's going to have to be more that you say than just simply you can stick things together if they're distinct. There has to be some additional constraints that get added on. Pretty much everybody agrees with that. The way that the unsatisfiable pair diagnosis allows you to reject that basic principle is to just insist that, just like you can't sellotape together bits of space-time that have different metric or topological properties, also you can't, even if they have the same metric or topological properties, you can't join together bits of space-time if what you get is a contradiction as a consequence, right? That's and that's just what you get in this case. So you think you can just combine, you're just combining reapers and there's no problem, but actually it turns out that if you do it this way, the outcome is contradictory. That's the principled reason for thinking that application of the patchwork principle has gone wrong now, because It's like a guide that's showing you around a town that you don't know, but he's just taking you to the wrong place. It's like an unreliable guide that's not showing you the stuff that you expected him to show you. He's taking you somewhere, and he said, you can go here, but you actually can't go there. So it's like a bad tourist guide or something. So we're basically saying you can use the Patchwork Principle in many cases. It's quite reliable, but just like everybody, you have to have some constraints on there. And all this is a very minimal constraint to just sort of remind everyone that as a guide, if it's showing you a possible world which is contradictory, but it's telling you that it's possible, then something's gone wrong, right? That's an impossible world, not a possible world. So it's obviously not reliably showing you just what's possible if in this case. And it's so going back to Prior again, you naively think, I can form this thought about the professor in room 13. That seems like the sort of thing I can think. But it turns out it isn't. You can't think that. So surprisingly, we've learned something. Logic taught us something. And it's the same thing here. It sort of feels like we can recombine things like this, no problem. But it turns out that logic just shows us that you can't do that. And so that's why we should see that there's something's going wrong with this patchwork principle here. And so by denying that premise, I don't have to say anything about the nature of space and time or causation or anything. I'm just simply saying you can't recombine things if their recombination is contradictory.
Do you have any anticipation what would William Lane Craig response from this unsatisfiable pair diagnosis?
Well, I think William Lane Craig's not the foremost defender of the Grim Reaper paradox, although he approves of the Grim Reaper paradox. He's not really doing very much work on it, and I'm not sure he's really done anything, published any papers on it. But the main guys would be Alex Proust and Rob Koons. So I think Koons has had conversations. He had a did a debate with Joe on this. So it was, I think, a few years ago, and maybe Joe's views are a bit more sophisticated now than they were then, although it's quite similar to what I was just advocating. And I think at the time, Koons wasn't seeing the connection between the Grim Reaper, the unsatisfiable pair diagnosis, and specifically the denial of the patchwork principle premise. At least that's how it went to begin with. I think it was he just thought all the stuff about saying it's a logical issue and not metaphysical was missing the point. And of course it's a contradiction. That's the whole point of the argument, is to show that there's something gone wrong, et cetera, et cetera. So and I think it's reasonably subtle, so it's fair enough. But the on the denial of the patchwork principle, he seemed to think that you can restrict the patchwork principle, but when you do so, it needs to be a causal restriction. So for instance, Joe brought up this issue of, like, I can imagine, one person writhing around in agony, right? And if the universe was and then the thought was just like, we could just fill the world with nothing but people writhing around in agony. Let's forget the whether it's finite or not. Suppose it's finite. Still, let's say it's like 100% full with nothing other than just copy after copy of people just in agony, just screaming and whatever, and that's it from start to finish. Now that's implausibly incompatible with, like, a loving God. He wouldn't actualize a world where there's nothing but people suffering the whole time, because they're not suffering in order to, provide opportunities for other people to be charitable or generous or something. There's nothing but agony the whole way through. So a loving God wouldn't actualize a world like that. It's like the worst possible world from a moral or suffering point of view. So, and he wouldn't actualize a world like that. But the patchwork principle seems to allow you to just copy and paste these things. So, I mean, if you're a theist, you're going to have to say that there's a restriction on the things you can copy and paste, even though there doesn't seem to be any kind of logical bar to that. There must be some reason. And basically, the thought is just, God would never allow that. He just, his character would just prevent him from being able to do it or something. But ultimately, some kind of causal restriction, like God just wouldn't let that happen. And his, and that is a kind of causal restriction that prevents it from taking place. So Kuhn's thinks that you can have causal restrictions like that, but that there's something wrong with saying the type of restriction I had in mind was just simply to say you can't recombine things when the result is logically contradictory. He thinks that's like not a legitimate type of restriction. I think he had this idea that what would happen would mean that you can never use a kind of reductio argument, which is basically this kind of like from some premises, if you get a contradiction, then one of the premises is false. He was his thought was if you know the if what we were saying was correct, you could never like have those types of arguments. But I think that that's I just think that that's I might be misunderstanding a point there, but it seems to me that that's just obviously not right. I mean the very argument we're looking at is a reductio, and we're denying one of the premises. So I'm not sure why he thinks that it would undermine arguments of that structure. But like I said, I might be misremembering or just misunderstanding the point that he had there. But I think broadly speaking, that's I mean, some people have traditionally pushed back against this unsatisfiable pair diagnosis because they kind of push the line, like we were talking about with the Terminator before, where they'll say, look, it's implausible to think that you know, the Terminator just fails because he slips on a banana skin, or the gun jams, or John Connor ducks out the way at the last minute. Like, it couldn't just be coincidence after coincidence that prevents the Terminator from killing him. I mean, if he's not going to kill him, something causal must explain why he's not going to do it, like a mysterious force of or something, right? Which is implausible. And so they'll use that to say, this is why time travel is impossible. You just can't travel back in time, because if you could, then there'd have to be some mysterious force preventing contradictions from arising. And that's all just very implausible, they'll say, right? So, and then they'll use that same kind of line here by saying, look, if you're the unsatisfiable pair diagnosis person, you're basically saying you can't arrange reapers in these paradoxical ways. But like, what's stopping you? There's no mysterious force preventing you from lining up the reapers, right? And so there's that mysterious force objection is trying to push back against the unsatisfiable pair. But it seems to me that that's much weaker as a response, because I mean nobody thinks that a mysterious force prevents you from crossing all of the bridges of Königsberg, right? Like as if somebody's gonna trip you up, an invisible chaperone will trip you up or something, push you into the river or something. Nobody thinks that. We all understand that you can't complete that task because it's, you know, inconsistent. And it just seems to me that that's enough to understand what's going on here. We just have a logical contradiction, and that is part of the explanation of why it can't happen. Like, part of the reason why you can't cross all the bridges in Königsberg is because graph theory says you can't. That is part of the explanation. And if somebody thinks that that's mysterious, I think they just don't understand the proof and what's going on there, because when you do, it's very clear.
Okay, so this is I try to summarize this. For the theist, why we can't do such thing is because mysterious force. And for people like who agrees with about unsatisfiable pair diagnosis, they just say the mysterious force is the logical contradiction. What do you think about that statement?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say it was a mysterious force. I would say there's no need for a mysterious force, because you know it's just a contradiction, right? It's like it's not a genuine circumstance. It's not like there's some room in my house, but I just can't go in it because whenever I try, there's a force field that prevents me from going in there. That would be weird, right? But the way I'm trying to argue is that it's more like there just isn't a room in my house. Right, there's no room at all such that I can't go in it. It's not like there is a room and it's empty and I can't go in there. The region that we're thinking about, the world where the Terminator kills John Connor, or the world where you cross all the bridges of Königsberg without doubling back on yourself, they're actually just not worlds at all. They're just an inconsistent description. and that doesn't pick out a possible world. So it's like there isn't a place that you're forbidden from going to. That it would be weird if there was a place and you somehow couldn't get there. But this, what we're saying is that there just is no such space, no region that's forbidden to you. It's just a failure to describe anything because it's a contradiction. Contradiction just means like there's all this logical space, and the because the terms contradict one another, you're actually just picking out none of that space. Right, that's what's going. It's just a failure to find anything on the dartboard of possibility. You've just missed the board altogether, and thereby not hit anything possible. I don't know if that's more helpful. These are all analogies.
That's pretty helpful. What I think is, Kalam cosmological argument is. We're going back to the Kalam argument. Mm-hmm. What I think is it's so easy to understand, but it's harder to refute. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's very, very typical in not just philosophy, but it's way easier to say something wrong than it is to explain why that thing is wrong. You know, you'll have politicians who will say stuff in when they're giving a speech or something that's, you know, not quite right, and it takes ages for the journalist to explain the detail of why the president said something that's not correct. And it takes 2 seconds to say the thing, but 25 minutes to explain clearly why that thing was wrong. And the same sort of thing happens in philosophy too. It's very easy to make a claim, regardless of the topic that you're arguing for. It's not just like Christians say things in the it's easy for them and it's hard for atheists or something. Atheists can also say stuff that's wrong, and Christian could spend ages having to explain why that's wrong as well. It's just clearing up a mess is much harder to do than making a mess in the first place. But that's just typical. It's just the asymmetry of being positive, making a case, and negative of like cleaning up or destroying that case. One of them is just intrinsically harder to do than the other one.
Last question. I'm making a petition about changing the name of a philosopher into one of these two things. The first one is a metaphysician, or the second one is armchair physician. What do you think is the better way to change, if we have to change the name of philosopher? It's not a very serious question, I hope you understand that. But
well,
yeah,
metaphysics is only one aspect of philosophy. So you wouldn't want to rename philosophers all to be metaphysicians, because some of them are doing ethics or I don't know, other stuff that's not, or just logic, I don't know, who aren't really doing metaphysics. So I don't think it would be fair to label all of those people and it'll be political philosophy or aesthetics or something. They're not doing metaphysics. I think they would object, definitely. There is something a bit weird about, it's because the term is like metaphysician, but a physician is just another name for a doctor. So, right, whereas it's metaphysics, so it should be metaphysicist. Mm. I don't know why it's metaphysician.
Yeah. I was wrong. It's metaphysicist. Yeah, not metaphysician. Metaphysicist.
Yeah, so I'd go along with changing metaphysician to metaphysicist.
Metaphysicist. Okay. Okay. That's all. Thank you. Thanks a lot, Dr. Alex Malpass.
Yeah. No problem. Thanks for having me.